Hello, Byron.
Hi, David.
Now, usually on Blogging Heads TV, we're amiable and chatty and try to be friendly, even across ideological dividing lines.
Even across the divide, that's right.
Even across the divide. But I have to confess that today that's going to be quite a challenge for me, because in the last few days...
It's going to be a special anger edition.
I'm writing about
my
new book, Hubris,
right.
The Inside Story of Spin Scandal and the Selling of the Iraq War. You have called me a conspiracy theorist, and you have impugned my journalistic integrity. Now, my publicist has put the kibosh on me engaging in blogosphere-like debates about the book until the book comes out, which will be later next week. Or you can pre-order now on Amazon.com.
So it's a one-week kibosh.
In any event, I'd like to extend to you an invitation, or perhaps you might see it as a challenge, to come back next week or the week thereafter, depending on scheduling, and then go at it about the book, the leaks, and your case that I am not a solid journalist.
I see it as an invitation, and I'll be happy to accept. But could we talk a little bit about the first thing you raised was the conspiracy theorist thing?
So, I'm not getting into it now.
Well, wait a minute. You can't raise it and then not talk about it.
Well, you can refer people to your piece in which you labeled me that, and they can then... They can get all prepped and all excited for the battle to come.
David, there's a certain amount of artificiality here, because you're saying you can't talk about a book, and the book has had a very splashy excerpt published in Newsweek.
That's right.
Your co-author has appeared on the Today Show talking about the book.
That's right. We did.
Has appeared on Hardball talking
splash.
About the book. Has appeared on NPR talking about the book. And you have appeared on Fox talking about the book.
We did an initial splash on the first day, and now we're told to sit tight and talk about it.
Now there is a one-week kibosh.
And that was what I talked about with the chief blogging head, Bob Wright.
That's correct.
And he sent you a note, I think, to that extent.
Well, if you had simply...
I'm not going to get into it. I'm not going to get into it now. We'll have plenty... You've written about it extensively on the National Review. We'll put that up on the link. Look to your left or right, depending where it appears on the screen. And people can get everything they want up to now. As they say, as the Bush White House said for 3 years, we're not going to be commenting upon this. Well, it's under investigation. Well, I'm not going to be commenting on it any further until next week. So let's just put it off to then.
All right. So we can't talk about your stories called The Cheney Conspiracy...
Listen, we're not talking about it.
Oh,
now,
okay.
You know? We can put those links up too. You've had your say. You've said it. Where you get to post the National Review, and
posted davidcorn.com. We should say, and also at bushlies.com.
No, it's davidcorn.com. That's the name of the site.
Oh, but if you go to bushlies.com,
yeah,
you get to davidcorn.com,
right? It bounces to it. Now, listen, if you're set on trying to have this debate now, we can just have the shortest blogging head, program in history.
Well, I would
we
say
can do that because I'm just not going to do it. I talked to Bob Wright about that earlier on, and he said that was fine.
I would
now,
say that mentioning that you have
I'm
a website.
To push this in here.
David.
I'm ready to move on to Katrina, Iraq, George Allen, and JonBenet.
I'm going to do it in 1 second, but I'm going to say that mentioning that you have a website called bushlies.com is not talking about your book. It just isn't.
Well, yes, okay, but for some reason you brought it up in the context of my book, so...
And that you published stories
saying,
is there a chain of conspiracy? It's not about your book.
So,
but we can go on to Katrina. Let's go on to Katrina.
Let's go on to Katrina, and we'll pick this up down the road. The thriller in Manila, people can tune in then. I was going to start with Iraq, but let's start with Katrina. I did several interviews, not about my book, but about Katrina this week,
right,
with some foreign journalists and even people in town. And the question seemed to be, to what extent will Katrina, what impact, long-term impact will it have on Bush's legacy? My belief is that, these things never come at a particularly good time for a president or for the people who are killed and harmed by such events. But that it came at a time when things are turning with public opinion on the war, also the Harriet Myers business, and it really left a deep, dark imprint on the American political psyche regarding George Bush. Just not getting it, not caring, not doing enough. The whole Michael Brown episode, and I think in some ways it's irreparable. But this will, you know, he just can't escape this no matter what happens, and nor do I think that he should be able to. But what's your take?
All right, my take is, first of all, on something like the Iraq War, I mean, look, that's Bush's baby. That will be his legacy, and whatever happens there will be his legacy. Katrina is more complicated than that, and I think that the legacy of Katrina will be more mixed, and that Bush made some clear mistakes, beginning with the PR mistake of flying over New Orleans and kind of dipping the wings of Air Force One and taking a look at it and having a concerned picture taken of himself. That was a disastrously bad PR decision. To the more substantive decisions of being too deferential to the mayor of New Orleans and the governor of Louisiana, who are not faring very well in some of the books, like Douglas Brinkley's book that have been mm-hmm. written about Katrina. I want to bring up something that's in the New York Times today. I don't know if you saw it. There's a story about this guy, Harry Anderson. He's an actor, and he loved New Orleans, and he moved to New Orleans in 2000. And
is he the magician who did Night Court?
Exactly. He's that guy.
Well, he used to do Saturday Night Live before he became a sitcom actor, and he was marvelous as a comic magician. Then he kind of made a lot of money doing Night Court.
Right.
Anyway, he
falls in love with New Orleans. He moves there, and he opens up a nightclub mm-hmm. where he performs. It's in the French Quarter. And now he's mm-hmm. decided, after falling in love, and after Katrina, he stays, he rides out Katrina in the French Quarter, he keeps his business open, he has town meetings there. I mean, he really tries to make things better in New Orleans, and now he's decided to move, and this story is about his decision to move to Asheville, North Carolina. Let me read you a couple of things from this. One of the reasons he decided to move, quote, this is the New York Times, "The city is tried to more than double the $17,000 a year property taxes. A lawyer for Anderson had the amount reduced, but, quote, that just meant that the lawyer got the money instead of the city," says Mr. Anderson. "Then in May, there was a repeat of an attack that had occurred more than a year before when a stranger approached Mr. Anderson, slammed his face into the side of a building, and cursed him, saying, 'You killed the Matador.'" Now, the Matador was the name of the bar that Anderson's replaced. "Then there was the energy company, Entergy, the local electricity company, which is in bankruptcy and has instituted rate increases that have mystified many residents. It sent a $900 bill for an apartment in the club building that had no electricity. And later, a monthly electric bill came for a small shop space in the building. That came to $7,300. But it was the recent mayoral election," Mr. Anderson told the New York Times, "that, quote, was the nail in the coffin. The re-election of Ray Nagin, whom Mr. Anderson holds largely responsible for New Orleans' drift since the hurricane, came as a shock. The Sunday after the May 20 election," Anderson said, "he walked the streets of the quarter, angry with the result that, quote, pulled the rug out under from any hope of change for the better." So I think we can talk about New Orleans as a Bush legacy, and certainly it hurt Bush, and certainly Bush made mistakes. But the real legacy of Katrina is going to be much more complicated, and blame is going to be spread around, and I frankly believe more of it will end up with the authorities in Louisiana than with Bush.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I think local people down there are right to put the onus on the people closest to them, you know, who are supposed to look out for their interests. I think nationally, though, people, you know, who aren't directly impacted will look at the federal government's response. That's where they have some input over. That's, you know, that would have been the surrogate for the national community to get involved and do the right thing in New Orleans. And of course, the person in charge of that surrogate force, the national federal government, was George Bush. And, you know, he was slow, as was Andy Card, and Cheney was off fly fishing, Condoleezza Rice was buying shoes on Fifth Avenue. A lot of this was detailed, I can't even say to humorous effect, in Spike Lee's film on HBO, which aired, I think, again this week.
Now, you've seen that, right?
Yeah, and I have to say, I thought it was very well done. It was, you know, it was a lot less Bush bashing than one might expect, but a lot more moderate in tone than one might expect. There were a few, I thought, you know, tin ear moments, such as when he puts on Harry Belafonte and Al Sharpton, because by and large it's all voices from New Orleans,
yes.
And he has Ray Nagin and Eddie Compass, but just mainly people who lived through the disaster, representing all races and all economic divisions. And I thought, and they just tell the story, and Spike doesn't really intrude at all, and the footage is, of course, is so gripping that I thought, you know, it was by and large a pretty compelling account of what happened, and you can see why people are still mad, and you can see, you know, he had Ray Nagin there defending himself, but also people on the documentary who were critical
right. Of
Ray Nagin and his performance. And for someone who's used to seeing Spike Lee as only a polemicist working through the art of film, he really showed some great documentary skills in putting this together. The second half, I thought, was a little less formed than the first half. But anyway, if it airs again, I recommend people see it and don't pay attention so much when Spike puts his friends on who weren't down in the
Well, since you've seen it and I haven't, does he raise these conspiracy theories about the levees being intentionally
Yes, he does, because, and it's interesting, because it's a small part of the film. He doesn't suggest that it happened. He quotes people, residents, who believe that it happened,
right.
which is reported.
Well, there are, in fact,
responding.
People who believe it.
And he also reports on the history that in 70, 80 years ago, when they actually did destroy levees to flood certain parts of New Orleans for economic reasons, and they just happened to be, can you believe this? The poor, blacker neighborhoods. So he shows the history. He gives the Army Corps of Engineer the chance to say there's no evidence here, and then he moves on. So I know some reviewers have really latched on to that, but I thought he handled it pretty fairly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, well, let's move from Katrina to another disaster, and that
Jean
is
Benet?
The war in Iraq. You can quibble with my characterization, but there's something I wanted to ask you about.
Right.
It was about a year ago that the National Review, my friend Rich Lowry, your editor, your boss, wrote a piece saying that we're winning the war in Iraq. These days, I have the sense that conservatives and Republicans are really becoming unnerved, thinking that this may be a job that's too much for George W. Bush and his inherent abilities. You had Joe Scarborough, former Republican congressman on MSNBC about 2 weeks ago, doing a segment, "Is the President an Idiot?" And he said that he believed he didn't have the intellectual depth for the job. I spoke to a conservative talk show host the other day. We said, yeah, sometimes he can be moronic. I was on TV a couple of days ago with Matthew Continenti of Weekly Standard and Linda Chavez, who both said that they think Bush doesn't have a plan. Their plan is to send more troops. But I sense there's some conservative unease out there that's building. How do you see it?
Well, a couple of things. I think you're oversimplifying what National Review has written. We did a cover story.
Well, Rich did write that.
I did, but what I was going to point out is that Rich also did a cover story a year before that in, I believe it was October of 04. It was really close before the elections, and it was a big cover story, and I believe the cover headline was "Iraq, What Went Wrong?" And so I think that to suggest that...
So he's at it both ways.
Yeah, well, it seemed to be going better after a while. But look, at various times in Iraq, there have clearly been, there's been reason for hope, and then that was dashed. So it's not crazy that you would be doing reporting, at various stages of the war. But all I'm saying is that National Review has not been some sort of Pollyanna-ish or cheerleader for
the
war.
Well, William Buckley has been very good in saying that that John Kerry got it right and that the war was a mistake. But nevertheless,
now Buckley has said Buckley has said that the war has failed, and there's no doubt that there are a number of conservatives who believe that, and then there are other people like John McCain who basically say it ain't broke but it's bent and it has to be fixed and we can't lose. So I think, to me, conservatives Republicans are divided between two or three different camps. One is the, it's all lost, either Bush has screwed it up, or more like George Will, it was kind of an impossible mission to undertake in the beginning. There are the stay-the-course conservatives, or add-troop conservatives, and there are the John McCain conservatives who are essentially saying, when we left Vietnam, we could be kind of sure they weren't coming after us. That's not the case here, so we have to continue. So I think it's fair
Isn't
to say that Republicans
are
as divided about the war as Democrats are.
And do you think that there, in getting to Bush's qualities and talents and skills as a commander-in-chief, are some beginning to worry that it's going poorly? Because of
let me say.
He's not incurious. He isn't curious and just doesn't.
My reaction to the Scarborough thing, is Bush an idiot thing, was that it was just really kind of the worst of cable TV, topic raising. Go to MSNBC.com and vote today. Is Bush an idiot? I just didn't think it was very good. look, I think that a number of conservatives have raised recently and have raised for a long time the fact that Bush is one of the worst public speakers and someone who should be expected to be able to get across ideas and inspire people. Bush is very bad at that. His presidency will be remembered for a number of set-piece speeches that were truly great speeches. His speech, I think, was at September 20th, 2001, after the 2001 attacks. His first inaugural address, a number of other speeches, and maybe including his second inaugural address, which may be viewed as evidence for why his presidency went wrong. But anyway, he's given a bunch of great speeches that were written and approved by him. But in terms of speaking extemporaneously, going for press conferences, right, meeting with groups of people, he's just not very good at it. And I
you know what threw me what threw me last week,
what?
During that press conference he gave,
yeah,
was when Martha Raddatz of ABC News asked him, you know, about his strategy,
right,
in Iraq, whether he should be changing his strategy, what he thought about it. And he started talking about tactics. Well, we've changed our tactics.
Right.
And then she said to him, well, I'm not asking about tactics. I'm asking about strategy. And he said, well, I thought I answered the question.
Right.
And that gave me pause, because anybody in charge of a big project should know what the difference is between strategy and tactics. The closest he got to talking about it was saying our strategy is to, you know, help the people of Iraq achieve their goal of freedom.
Right.
That's not a strategy. That's a goal.
Right.
And so that he, at this point in the war, 3 years plus, he can't get out there and talk about strategy,
yeah,
what it is,
yeah,
or how to change it, without talking about rhetorical goals and passing the buck to commanders.
Yeah,
and,
remember in the...
I know he's not the most articulate guy, but I still would expect him to be able to grasp and convey and communicate some of these ideas and concepts,
yeah,
that should be, pushing
right,
him forward in Iraq.
Remember back in the Clinton administration and toward the end of it, when Gore,
I try not to remember
when
that
Gore
one,
was not, about to run, you know, people would always, Gore supporters would always say, you know, in private, he's funny, he's smart, he's self-deprecating, he's relaxed, he's warm, he's all of these great things that he isn't in public. Conservatives say some of the same things about Bush because he can be terrible in public, and yet people who have talked to him, and he has been having some journalists in lately, not me, and discussing informally.
Of course, you'll let Blogging Hits TV get the exclusive on your visit with George Bush when it happens.
I will. As a matter of fact, I'll even take the computer there, but I may have trouble setting it up. But I will say that Bush did meet with about five staffers from National Review for an hour in the Oval Office in maybe, it was late 03. And I was there, and I have to say, I found him extremely impressive. He was knowledgeable. He was relaxed. He put together points very cogently. He conveyed his own sense of determination very well, but not in just a kind of a rote, stay the course kind of way. I was struck by the difference between him in private and in public. So I sound like all those people who are saying Al Gore's a really great, warm guy. But the fact is that no matter how good he is in private, part of the president's job is to communicate this in public. And one thing I will say...
Well, especially if you're going to take on a moral crusading mission to bring democracy to the Middle East.
It's crucial. It's absolutely crucial.
On the theory that if you, you know, secede in Iraq, you know, we'll have a tsunami of democracy throughout the region.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to do that PR and winning hearts and minds, it has to be, you know, at least 30% of the job.
But, you know, in terms of Iraq, I will say, even though the bigger strategy has remained basically unchanged, which is trying to defeat the insurgency, build up the political system, and restore the, you know, infrastructure and the economy, the administration and the military in particular have been constantly changing and evolving, trying to adapt to something that maybe they should have foreseen it, but they didn't. And been a very, very flexible threat and growing threat from the insurgency. I think you do the military and the administration itself a disservice by suggesting that they were just sort of steamrolling ahead, stay the course. I think for a long, long time.
I'm sure the guys on the ground are trying as hard as they can. I mean, we still though see this tremendous rise and deaths, 10,000 civilians over the past 3 months. And the front page of the Post today, the Washington Post, you're traveling, you may not have seen it, has this horrific story about how Shia militias are storming hospitals,
right,
of all places, and pulling Sunnis out of their bed and killing them. And of course, the health ministry is controlled by the Shiites, and there's all, and they can't get a, they can't even get a grip on this. Hospitals used to be seen as a place of safe harbor,
right,
and haven in Baghdad, but even that's gone now. So I'm sure the commanders are trying as hard as they can to get a fix on this. But as we both kind of said earlier, there are people who believe that the mission may be an impossible mission. Let's, you know, talking about Republicans and how they come across, one person was, who's been talked about within Republican circles as being a possible successor to George Bush is another George, George Allen.
Oh, George Allen.
George
yeah,
Allen,
right.
From Virginia. And he's been in deep macaca lately.
Yeah.
Two, 3 weeks ago, he made that comment.
We have a one macaca joke quota, by the way, and you just made it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, so we just used it. But we'll talk about it seriously for a moment because I know you've been doing some reporting on him, and I want to get to that. But for anybody who's been focusing too much on JonBenet Ramsey and missed the macaca episode, George Allen was at a campaign event, and there was a member of the campaign staff of Jim Webb, his Democratic opponent, who was taping him, as happens much these days, looking for him to make a slip up or something they could use against
right.
him. And he pointed the fellow out in the audience, and the guy is an Indian-American with a funny haircut, might be a mohawk, might be a mullet, it might be something that has no name. And he said, you know, that macaque over there, you know, welcome to the real world. Well, your guy goes out to Hollywood, you know, here,
right.
this is real Virginia. And it turns out, you know, what does macaque mean? There's been some debate. It is a term, it is a certain type of monkey. It is in Africa and some places considered a racial epithet for a dark-skinned person. George Allen's mom happens to be from Tunisia. He said it had to do with his haircut. Anyway, people probably, if you don't know by now, look it up. But in any event, it sort of raised issues.
Had you ever heard of this as an epithet, by the way, before this? Had you ever heard of that being used as an epithet?
Well, I'm not from Tunisia, nor is my
parents. I mean, I hadn't. Tunisia, I'm just asking.
But I'm sure there are plenty of racial epithets out there in other languages that I have yet heard or that I yet know about. But this, you know, he's not just running for Senate, as you know. He's running for the Republican presidential nomination. And one question about him has been whether, you know, how, to be blunt about it, where he falls on the boob scale. And I've talked enough about George Allen. You take it.
All right, well, there's a couple of things. And you're right. He's in two different races. He's in the race for re-election against Jim Webb, the Democrat, and he wants to win the Republican presidential nomination for 08. So you kind of need to look at those separately. I think, to begin with, I think part of the problem with the whole macaca thing, which Allen has now apologized for over and over again, is that
he's signing a Guinness book?
Yeah, first he dissembled on it, and then he apologized, and then, but you know, it's been on YouTube, so everybody could see it. And by the way, the use of these trackers, people from the other campaigns, they do it all the time. Every time, if you're a major candidate, every time you make a campaign stop, there's somebody from your opponent's campaign there watching, and listening, and now videotaping to see if you screw up in any way. So
this, it's great. I love
it's a standard feature of campaigns, and I would assume that the Allen people have somebody with a camera tracking Webb around. And I think the problem was, obviously the guy from the Webb campaign was an American born in Virginia, and so this whole kind of welcome to America thing was off. And the other thing is that, you know, he's a kid. He's a young person working for the campaign, and it kind of looked like the big guy, the other candidate, was beating on him. And, you know, that people don't like that. I mean, people don't like it when you beat on somebody smaller than you are, if you have such people.
Always shoot up. Always shoot up rather than shoot
so
down.
Anyway, now, as far as the Virginia race is concerned, the polls since the whole macaque incident have shown Webb getting much closer and even pulling even with Allen. Allen used to be ahead by a reasonably comfortable margin. So clearly things
right.
are moving there. I should point out that, you know, the New Republic got a lot of mileage on a piece they did about Allen's alleged affection for all things Confederate. His affection for things Confederate is at least matched by Webb's. Webb is very proud of his Confederate forebears, one of whom was named Robert E. Lee Webb, and whose son, James Webb, named Robert in honor of that person. And Webb gave a speech several years ago at the Confederate Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery, in which he spoke with great reverence about his forebears who fought for the Confederacy and how that they and their motives were often misunderstood. So I think that that you know, part of the Mukaka issue is one thing, but the sort of general racist Southern issue, which Webb's people are trying to feed the Mukaka thing into, is a little more complicated. Now,
but Webb never had a noose in his office as George Allen did, as far as I know.
Well, to my knowledge, I can't break any news about that.
As far as walking around as a high school kid with a Confederate pin on, you know, we all do lots of stupid things.
Well, but the New Republic made a huge story about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but the fact that he had a noose in his office when he was an adult, well, to me, that, you know.
Well, look, I can't tell you. Well, look, having a noose does not necessarily refer to lynching, or at least racial lynching. I mean, we also know that Allen is a big on all things Western. He wears cowboy boots all the time.
Yeah.
And it's also kind of a law, you know, a Dodge City lawman thing. So, I'm not going to say that, I'm not going to defend Allen on this, but the news thing, I think, is not dispositive of anything. But let me get to the presidential race. And there are two things involved in this. One, the closer this thing has gotten with Webb, the more competitive, it means that Allen has not been able to campaign much of anywhere. I've been down to South Carolina a few times to cover McCain and to cover Giuliani. Apparently Mitt Romney is in South Carolina, you know, every 15 minutes. Mike Huckabee's going there. A lot of people go in there. But Allen isn't, because he's tied down with his campaign in Virginia. And then the other thing is that even before he was tied down, Allen basically underwhelmed a number of conservative audiences. So people have a lot of doubts about him. And even in South Carolina, where Allen's wife is a graduate of the University of South Carolina, he's well-liked there. But I think people have doubts about the relative quality of him as a candidate versus a McCain or even a Giuliani, if that, if his problems with social conservatives can be bridged. So, you know, Allen is clearly at a low point right now, and even if he didn't have this whole Mukaka stuff, he had clearly underwhelmed people, you know, in the months before that.
Well, he's not an overwhelming type of fellow, to the extent that I've seen him.
The other thing is people think he's a little too bushy.
One advantage. I mean, he has one big advantage over Jim Webb so far. Last time I checked, he had about $12 million to Webb's $1 million. That might have changed a little bit recently. And money will get you pretty far in politics, even after you've shot yourself.
Well, you know, Jim Webb is one of the new favorites of the Netroots contributors who had emptied their...
Sure, yeah, he may close the gap, but it's a pretty big gap to close, even when you get the bloggers behind you. Now, we saved the big story of the week for the end, and that's JonBenet Ramsey.
Absolutely.
I know that's what blogging head viewers have been obsessing about. I don't know about you, but, like, you know, within a day of the story breaking, it was quite clear to me that this guy had nothing to do with
it. Absolutely.
As soon as his family started coming out saying, we hate him, we'd like him to go away forever,
right,
but he was with us on Christmas,
you
know, you just knew that everyone should just take a deep breath and say, until we resolve that, there's nothing to talk
That's
about.
That's right.
And so what happened? They just can't, I guess it's through a cable. The cable producers can't help themselves, can they?
Well, look, I mean, this is a story of some interest. And, you know, it happened in December 1996, and it was a particularly grisly murder, and the victim was as innocent as a victim can be, a little six-year-old girl. And what happened was, afterwards, the parents of JonBenet Ramsey, John and Patsy Ramsey, began behaving in a very O.J. sort of way. And you have to remember, this was just a year, I think, after the incredible frenzy of the O.J. Simpson trial and his acquittal. And they lawyered up big time. They wouldn't talk to police. They resisted in a number of ways. And, you know, a lot of suspicion, including my own, centered on the Ramseys. And the case has never been solved. The Ramseys later moved here to Atlanta. Patsy Ramsey died in the last few months, but John Ramsey is still around. And so
he ran for office, didn't he?
An unsolved murder is a serious thing, and so when this thing came up, I don't fault the press or certainly the police for making a big deal of it. But There was a question at the press conference for the district attorney out in Boulder yesterday, and the question was, other than all of these emails that John Mark Carr exchanged with Tracy, this professor out there who's made a number of documentaries that are very favorable to the Ramseys, other than all the emails and what Carr said in all these emails, do you have any evidence to suggest that Carr was the guy who did it? Do you have anything to place him in Boulder or in Colorado around the time of the murder? Do you have anything else at all? And the district attorney hemmed and hawed and hemmed and hawed and tried not to answer the question, and the answer was finally no, they didn't have anything else. But they said that the emails were kind of internally consistent, that is, unrelated points that Carr had made. When they checked him out, those were true, so they felt this was so important, and they... Then, since because of the nature of the DNA sample that was left over from the murder scene, they had to get an actual sort of swab in the mouth kind of sample from Carr. They couldn't just do it surreptitiously from something he had touched. So they had to do this in part to protect children in Thailand who might be victimized by him. You know, and so the whole thing happened. But you know, I have to say that most of the journalism, or most of the advocacy, I should say, the advocacy in the last several years that has been pushing the so-called intruder theory can be traced back in some part to the Ramseys and their financing. And this guy, the Professor Tracy's movies, I think, can. And, you know, this is...
Well, I still think that... I mean, I don't disagree with anything that you said. I think it's a fine analysis. I write mystery murders... mystery novels and short stories on the side, and I like a good mystery. I like a good murder mystery. But you know, there is still something about this that, you know, makes me squirm. You know, the fact that we had these, you know, these weird videos of her as a toddler pageant queen that are very voyeuristic in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, you want unsolved, you know, murder mysteries involving kids, we got dozens of those each month or each year here in Washington D.C. You know, there are horrific stories across this land of ours, and yet, you know, the media tends to, you know, latch on to one or two stories where there are good narratives, where there are compelling questions or compelling figures. You may hate them, you may love them, and you know, to try to turn the news into miniseries, and you know, they had a whole other shot with JonBenet Ramsey here. It's kind of fizzling out. And just as it's fizzling out, I notice that they now have a felonious polygamist.
Yeah, right,
captured,
I saw that
yesterday. So maybe they can segue into that. There's still something a little bit unnerving. I almost wish you can sort of segregate this type of news, which really, while interesting and titillating, has really nothing to do with our lives, from the serious news that does.
Well, you know, I can't get excited about this polygamous thing, you know, but listen, on the...
You weren't a fan of Big Love on HBO?
on the Ramsey thing, I mean, there are a couple of reasons. I think the video of the little girl, you know, performing at these pageants and everything did creep a lot of people out because she seemed to be kind of tarted up and behaving in an unnaturally adult-like way for such a small child, and I think that made people feel very weird. But the very fact that there was video, and a lot of video of her, pushed the case quite a bit. I remember when I worked at Channel 4 in Washington, I can't remember the name, but there was a spectacular and unsolved murder of a very, very young girl, and there was video of her, I think, standing by the Christmas tree singing Mary Had a Little Lamb or some totally heartbreaking piece of video, and I have no doubt that case got a lot more coverage because of that video and its use on television and what it conveyed to viewers. So
hey, they need to feed the beast. They need pictures to do that.
Yeah, it's 24 hours.
That's what happens. Yeah. Okay, well, I think we've run through our topic topic list. So thanks for
so we agree to meet again, right?
The battle at hand. We shall meet again. We will coordinate our schedules and come back once my book Hubris comes out next week, and go ahead. Maybe we'll have our special All Hubris episode of Blogging at TV.
All Hubris.
Okay, so with that, we go to our magic buttons here, and we say goodbye at the same time and click off.
All right, so what we're going to do is say goodbye and then click, right?
Yep. Goodbye.
Bye.